As soon as his hands closed around the adamantite handle, Wulfgar sensed the worth of the magical warhammer. The diamond-filled runes caught the glow of the forge and sent a myriad of reflections dancing about the room. The barbarians of Wulfgar's tribe had always prided themselves on the fine weapons they kept, even measuring the worth of a man by the quality of his spear or sword. But Wulfgar had never seen anything to match the exquisite detail and sheer strength of Aegis Fang. It balanced so well in his huge hands, and its height and weight fit him so perfectly, that he felt as if he had been born to wield this weapon. He told himself at once that he would pray for many nights to the gods of fate for delivering this prize unto him. Certainly they deserved his thanks, as did Brunner.
"You have my word,"
Wulfgar stammered, so overcome by the magnificent gift that he could hardly speak. He steadied himself so that he could say more. But by the time he was able to pull his gaze from the magnificent hammer, Brunner was gone. The dwarf stomped through the long corridors toward his private chambers, mumbling curses at his weakness and hoping that none of his kin came upon him. With a cautious look around, he wiped the moisture from his gray eyes. 13. As the Wielder Bids.
"Gather together your people and go, Bigrin," the wizard told the enormous frost giant that stood before him in Kryshal Tirith's throne room. "Remember that you represent the army of Akar Kessel. You are the first group to go into the area, and secrecy is the key to our victory. Do not fail me. I shall be watching over your every move."
"We'll not fail ye, master," the giant responded. "The lair'll be set and readied for your coming."
"I have faith in you," Kessel assured the huge commander. "Now be off."
The frost giant lifted the blanketed mirror that Kessel had given it, gave one final bow to its master, and walked out of the room.
"You should not have sent them," hissed Ertu,
who had been standing invisibly beside the throne during the conversation.
"The Verbeeg and their frost giant leader will be easy to mark in a community of humans and dwarves."
"Bigrin is a wise leader," Kessel shot back, angered at the demon's impertinence.
"The giant is cunning enough to keep troops out of sight."
"Yet the humans would have been better suited for this mission, as Kren Shinabon has shown you."
"I am the leader,"
screamed Kessel. He pulled the crystal shard out from under his robes and waved it menacingly at Ertu, leaning forward in an attempt to emphasize the threat.
"Kren Shinabon advises, but I decide. Do not forget your place, mighty demon. I am the wielder of the shard, and I shall not tolerate your questioning my every move."
Ertu's blood-red eyes narrowed dangerously, and Kessel straightened back in his throne, suddenly reconsidering the wisdom of threatening the demon. But Ertu calmed quickly, accepting the minor inconveniences of Kessel's foolish outbursts for the long-term gains it stood to make.
"Kren Shinabon has existed since the dawn of the world," the demon rasped, making one final point. "It has orchestrated 1,000 campaigns much grander than the one you are about to undertake. Perhaps you would be wise to give more credence to its advice."
Kessel twitched nervously. The shard had indeed counseled him to use the humans he would soon command in the first excursion into the region. He had been able to create 12 excuses to validate his choice of sending the giants, but in truth, he had sent Bigrin's people more to illustrate his undeniable command to himself, to the shard, and to the impertinent demon, than for any possible military gains.
"I shall follow Kren Shinabon's advice when I deem it appropriate," he told Ertu.
He pulled a second crystal, an exact duplicate of Kren Shinabon and the crystal he had used to raise this tower, out from one of the many pockets of his robe.
"Take this to the appropriate spot and perform the ceremony of raising," he instructed. "I shall join you through a mirror door when all is ready."
You wish to raise a second Kreishel Tirith while the first still stands?
Ertu balked.
The drain on the relic shall be enormous.
Silence!
Cassel ordered, trembling visibly.
Go and perform the ceremony. Let the shard remain my concern.
Ertu took the replica of the relic and bowed low. Without a further word, the demon stalked out of the room. It understood that Kessel was foolishly demonstrating his control over the shard at the expense of proper restraint and wise military tactics. The wizard did not have the capacity or the experience to orchestrate this campaign, yet the shard continued to back him. Ertu had made a secret offer to it to dispose of Kessel and take over as wielder. But Crenshinabon had refused the demon. It preferred the demonstrations that Kessel demanded of it to appease his own insecurities over the constant struggle of control it would face against the powerful demon. Though he walked among giants and trolls, the proud barbarian king's stature was not diminished. He strode defiantly through the iron door of the Black Tower and pushed through the wretched troll guards with a threatening growl. He hated this place of sorcery and had decided to ignore the calling when the singular spinet of the tower appeared on the horizon like an icy finger risen from the flat ground. Yet in the end, he could not resist the summons of the master of Kreishel Tirith. Heefstag hated the wizard. By all measures of a tribesman, Akar Kessel was weak, using tricks and demonic callings to do the work of muscle. And Heefstag hated him even more because he could not refute the power that the wizard commanded. The barbarian king threw aside the dangling beaded strands that sectioned off Akar Kessel's private audience hall on the tower's second level. The wizard reclined on a huge satin pillow in the middle of the room, his long painted fingernails tapping impatiently on the floor. Several nude slave girls, their minds bent and broken under the shard's domination, waited on every whim of the shard's wielder. It angered Heefstag to see women enslaved to such a puny, pitiful shell of a man. He considered, and not for the first time, a sudden charge, burying his great axe deep into the wizard's skull. But the room was filled with strategically located screens and pillars, and the barbarian knew, even if he refused to believe that the wizard's will could deny his rage, that Kessel's pet demon wouldn't be far from its master.
"So good that you could join me, noble Heefstag,"
said Kessel, in a calm, disarming way. Ertu and Crenshinabon were close at hand. He felt quite secure, even in the presence of the rugged barbarian king. He fondled one of the slaves absently, showing off his absolute rule.
"Really, you should have come sooner. Already many of my forces are assembled. The first group of scouts has already departed."
He leaned forward toward the barbarian to emphasize his point.
"If I can find no room for your people in my plans," he said with an evil snicker, "then I shall have no need for your people at all."
Heefstag didn't flinch or change his expression in the least.
"Come now, mighty king," the wizard crooned. "Sit and share in the riches of my table."
Heefstag clung to his pride and remained unmoving.
"Very well,"
snapped Kessel. He clenched his fist and uttered a command word.
"To whom do you owe your fealty?"
he demanded. Heefstag's body went rigid.
"To Akar Kessel,"
he responded, to his own repulsion.
"And tell me again, who is it that commands the tribes of the tundra?" "They follow me," Heefstag replied, "and I follow Akar Kessel. Akar Kessel commands the tribes of the tundra."
The wizard released his fist, and the barbarian king slumped back.
"I take little joy in doing that to you,"
said Kessel, rubbing a burr in one of his painted nails.
"Do not make me do it again."
He pulled a scroll out from behind the satin pillow and tossed it to the floor.
"Sit before me,"
he instructed Hiefstag.
Tell me again of your defeat.
Hiefstag took his place on the floor in front of his master and unrolled the parchment. It was a map of 10 towns. 14. Lavender Eyes. Brunner had regained his dour visage by the time he called on Wulfgar the following morning. Still, it touched the dwarf deeply, though he was able to hide the fact, to see Aegis Fang casually slung over the young barbarian's shoulder, as if it had always been there, and always belonged there. Wulfgar, too, was wearing a sullen mask. He passed it off as anger at being put into the service of another, but if he had examined his emotions more closely, he would have recognized that he was truly saddened about separating from the dwarf. Catti Bree was waiting for them at the junction of the final passage that led to the open air.
"Sure that you're a sour pair this fine morning," she said as they approached. "But not to mind. The sun will put a smile on your faces."
"You seemed pleased at this parting,"
Wulfgar answered, a bit perturbed, though the sparkle in his eyes at the sight of the girl belied his anger.
"You know, of course, that I am to leave the dwarven town this day."
Catti Bree waved her hand nonchalantly.
"You will be back soon enough," she smiled, "and be happy for your going. Consider the lessons you will soon learn needed if you're ever to reach your goals."
Brunner turned toward the barbarian. Wulfgar had never spoken with him about what lay ahead after the term of indenture, and the dwarf, though he meant to prepare Wulfgar as well as he could, hadn't honestly come to terms with Wolfgar's resolve to leave. Wulfgar scowled at the girl, showing her beyond doubt that their discussion of the unfulfilled vow was a private matter. Of her own discretion, Catti Bree hadn't intended to discuss the issue any further anyway. She simply enjoyed teasing some emotion out of Wulfgar. Catti Bree recognized the fire that burned in the proud young man. She saw it whenever he looked upon Brunner, his mentor, whether he would admit it or not. And she marked it whenever Wulfgar looked at her.
"I am Wulfgar, son of Beornigar,"
he boasted proudly, throwing back his broad shoulders and straightening his firm jaw.
"I have grown among the tribe of the Elk, the finest warriors in all of Icewind Dale. I know nothing of this tutor, but he will be hard-pressed indeed to teach me anything of the ways of battle."
Catti Bree exchanged a knowing smile with Brunner as the dwarf and Wulfgar passed her.
"Farewell, Wulfgar, son of Beornigar," she called after them. "When next we meet, I'll mark well your lessons of humility."
Wulfgar looked back and scowled again, but Catti Bree's wide smile diminished not at all. The two left the darkness of the mines shortly after dawn, traveling down through the rocky valley to the appointed spot where they were to meet the drow. It was a cloudless, warm summer day, the blue of the sky paled by the morning haze. Wulfgar stretched high into the air, reaching to the limits of his long muscles. His people were meant to live in the wide expanses of the open tundra, and he was relieved to be out of the stifling closeness of the dwarven-made caverns. Drisdo Urden was at the spot waiting for them when they arrived. The drow leaned against the shadowed side of a boulder, seeking relief from the glare of the sun. The hood of his cloak was pulled low in front of his face as further protection. Drizzt considered it the curse of his heritage that no matter how many years he remained among the surface dwellers, his body would never fully adapt to the sunlight. He held himself motionless, though he was fully aware of the approach of Brunner and Wulfgar. Let them make the first moves, he thought, wanting to judge how the boy would react to the new situation. Curious about the mysterious figure who was to be his new teacher and master, Wulfgar boldly walked over and stood directly in front of the drow. Drizzt watched him approach from under the shadows of his cowl, amazed at the graceful interplay of the huge man's corded muscles. The drow had originally planned to humor Brunner in his outrageous request for a short while, then make some excuse and be on his way. But as he noted the smooth flow and spring of the barbarian's long strides, an ease unusual in someone his size, Drizzt found himself growing interested in the challenge of developing the young man's seemingly limitless potential. Drizzt realized that the most painful part of meeting this man, as it is with everyone he met, would be Wolfgar's initial reaction to him. Anxious to get it over with, he pulled back his hood and squarely faced the barbarian. Wolfgar's eyes widened in horror and disgust.
"A dark elf!" he cried incredulously. "Sorceress dog!"
He turned on Brunner as though he had been betrayed.
"Surely you cannot ask this of me. I have no need nor desire to learn the magical deceits of his decrepit race."
"He'll teach ye to fight no more,"
Brunner said. The dwarf had expected this. He wasn't worried in the least, fully aware, as was Catti Bree, that Drizzt would teach the overly proud young man some needed humility. Wolfgar snorted defiantly.
"What can I learn of fighting from a weakling elf? My people are bred as true warriors."
He eyed Drizzt with open contempt.
"Not trickster dogs like his kind."
Drizzt calmly looked to Brunner for permission to begin the day's lesson. The dwarf smirked at the barbarian's ignorance and nodded his consent. In an eye blink, the two scimitars leaped from their sheaths and challenged the barbarian. Instinctively, Wolfgar raised his warhammer to strike. But Drizzt was the quicker. The flat sides of his weapon slapped in rapid succession against Wolfgar's cheeks, drawing thin streaks of blood. Even as the barbarian moved to counter, Drizzt spun again one of the deadly blades in a declining arc, its razor edge diving at the back of Wolfgar's knee. Wolfgar managed to slip his leg out of the way, but the action, as Drizzt had anticipated, put him off balance. The drow casually slipped the scimitars back into their leather scabbards as his foot slammed into the barbarian's stomach, sending him sprawling into the dust, the magical hammer flying from his hands.
"Now that ye understand each other," declared Brunner,
trying to hide his amusement for the sake of Wolfgar's fragile ego,
"I'll be leaving ye."
He looked questioningly at Drizzt to make sure that the drow was comfortable with the situation.
"Give me a few 10 days," Drizzt answered with a wink, returning the dwarf's smile.
Brunner turned back to Wolfgar, who had retrieved Aegis Fang and was resting on one knee, eyeing the elf with blank amazement.
"Heed his words, boy,"
the dwarf instructed one last time,
"or he'll cut ye into pieces small enough for a vulture's gullet."
For the first time in nearly 5 years, Wolfgar looked out beyond the borders of Ten Towns to the open stretch of Icewind Dale that spread wide before him. He and the drow had spent the remainder of their first day together hiking down the length of the valley and around the eastern spurs of Kelvin's Cairn. Here, just above the base of the northern side of the mountain, was the shallow cave where Drizzt made his home. Sparsely furnished with a few skins and some cooking pots, the cave had no luxuries to speak of. But it served the unpretentious drow ranger well, allowing him the privacy and seclusion that he preferred above the taunts and threats of the humans. To Wolfgar, whose people rarely stayed in any place longer than a single night, the cave itself seemed a luxury. As dusk began to settle over the tundra, Drizzt, in the comfortable shadows deeper in the cave, stirred from his short nap. Wolfgar was pleased that the drow had trusted him enough to sleep easily, so obviously vulnerable, on their first day together. This, coupled with the beating Drizzt had given him earlier, had caused Wolfgar to question his initial outrage at the sight of a dark elf.
"Do we begin our sessions this night, then?" Drizzt asked.
"You are the master,"
Wolfgar said bitterly. "I am only the slave."
"No more slave than I," replied Drizzt. Wolfgar turned to him curiously.
"We are both indebted to the dwarf," Drizzt explained. "I owe him my life many times over, and thus have agreed to teach you my skill in battle. You follow an oath that you made to him in exchange for your life. Thus you are obliged to learn what I have to teach. I am no man's master, nor would I ever want to be."
Wolfgar turned back to the tundra. He didn't fully trust Drizzt yet, though he couldn't figure out what ulterior motives the drow could possibly be pursuing with the friendly facade.
"We fulfill our debts to Brunner together," said Drizzt.
He empathized with the emotions Wulfgar was feeling as the young man gazed out over the plains of his homeland for the first time in years. "Enjoy this night, barbarian. Go about as you please and remember again the feel of the wind on your face. We shall begin at the fall of tomorrow's night." He left them to allow Wulfgar the privacy he desired. Wulfgar could not deny that he appreciated the respect the drow had shown him. During the daytime, Drizzt rested in the cool shadows of the cave while Wulfgar acclimated himself to the new area and hunted for their supper. By night, they fought. Drizzt pressed the young barbarian relentlessly, slapping him with the flat of a scimitar every time he opened a gap in his defenses. The exchanges often escalated dangerously, for Wulfgar was a proud warrior and grew enraged and frustrated at the drow's superiority. This only put the barbarian at a further disadvantage, for in his rage, all semblance of discipline flew from him. Drizzt was ever quick to point this out with a series of slaps and twists that ultimately left Wulfgar sprawled on the ground. To his credit, though, Drizzt never taunted the barbarian or tried to humiliate him. The drow went about his task methodically, understanding that the first order of business was to sharpen the barbarian's reflexes and teach him some concern for defense. Drizzt was truly impressed with Wulfgar's raw ability. The incredible potential of the young warrior staggered him. At first he feared that Wulfgar's stubborn pride and bitterness would render him untrainable, but the barbarian had risen to the challenge. Recognizing the benefits he could reap from one as adept with weapons as Drizzt, Wulfgar listened attentively. His pride, instead of limiting him into believing that he was already a mighty warrior and needed no further instruction, pushed him to grab at every advantage he could find that would help him to achieve his ambitious goals. By the end of the first 10 days, during those times he could control his volatile temper, he was already able to deflect many of Drizzt's cunning attacks. Drizzt said little during that first 10 days, though he would occasionally compliment the barbarian about a good parry or counter, or more generally on the improvement Wulfgar was showing in such a short time. Wulfgar found himself eagerly anticipating the drow's remarks whenever he executed an especially difficult maneuver, and dreading the inevitable slap whenever he foolishly left himself vulnerable. The young barbarian's respect for Drizzt continued to grow. Something about the drow, living without complaint in stoic solitude, touched Wulfgar's sense of honor. He couldn't yet guess why Drizzt had chosen such an existence, but he was certain from what he had already seen of the drow that it had something to do with principles. By the middle of the second 10 days, Wulfgar was in complete control of Aegis Fang, twisting its handle and head deftly to block the two whirring scimitars, and responding with cautiously measured thrusts of his own. Drizzt could see the subtle change taking place as the barbarian stopped reacting after the fact to the scimitar's deft cuts and thrusts and began recognizing his own vulnerable areas and anticipating the next attack. When he became convinced that Wulfgar's defenses were sufficiently strengthened, Drizzt began the lessons of attack. The drow knew that his style of offense would not be the most effective mode for Wulfgar. The barbarian could use his unrivaled strength more effectively than deceptive feints and twists. Wulfgar's people were naturally aggressive fighters, and striking came more easily to them than parrying. The mighty barbarian could fell a giant with a single, well-placed blow. All that he had left to learn was patience. Early one dark, moonless night, as he prepared himself for the evening's lesson, Wulfgar noticed the flare of a campfire far out on the plain. He watched, mesmerized, as several others sprang suddenly into sight, wondering if it might even be the fires of his own tribe. Drizzt silently approached, unnoticed by the engrossed barbarian. The drow's keen eyes had noted the stirrings of the distant camp long before the firelight had grown strong enough for Wulfgar to see. "Your people have survived," he said to comfort the young man. Wulfgar started at the sudden appearance of his teacher.
"You know of them?"
he asked. Drizzt moved beside him and stared out over the tundra. Their losses were great at the Battle of Bryn Shander, he said. And the winter that followed bit hard at the many women and children who had no men to hunt for them. They fled west to find the reindeer, banding together with other tribes for strength. The peoples still hold to the names of the original tribes, but in truth there are only two remaining, the tribe of the elk and the tribe of the bear. You are the tribe of the elk, I believe, Drizzt continued, drawing a nod from Wulfgar. Your people have done well. They dominate the plain now, and though more years will have to pass before the people of the tundra regain the strength they held before the battle, the younger warriors are already coming into manhood. Relief flooded through Wulfgar. He had feared that the Battle of Bryn Shander had decimated his people to a point from which they could never recover. The tundra was doubly harsh in the frozen winter, and Wulfgar often considered the possibility that the sudden loss of so many warriors, some of the tribes had lost every one of their menfolk, would doom the remaining people to slow death. You know much about my people, Wulfgar remarked. I have spent many days watching them, Drizzt explained, wondering what line of thought the barbarian was drawing. Learning their ways and tricks for prospering in such an unwelcoming land. Wulfgar chuckled softly and shook his head, further impressed by the sincere reverence the drow showed whenever he spoke of the natives of Icewind Dale. He had known the drow less than 2 10-days, but already he understood the character of Drizzt O'Werden well enough to know that his next observation about the drow was true to the mark.
I'll wager you even fell deer silently in the darkness, to be found in the morning light by people too hungry to question their good fortune.
Drizzt neither answered the remark nor changed the set of his gaze, but Wulfgar was confident in his guess.
Do you know of Ishtag?
The barbarian asked after a few moments of silence.
He was king of my tribe, a man of many scars and great renown.
Drizzt remembered the one-eyed barbarian well. The mere mention of his name sent a dull ache into the drow's shoulder, where he had been wounded by the huge man's heavy axe. He lives, Drizzt replied, somewhat shielding his contempt. Ishtag speaks for the whole of the north now. None of true enough blood remain to oppose him in combat, or speak out against him to hold him in check.
He is a mighty king,
Wulfgar said, oblivious to the venom in the drow's voice.
He is a savage fighter,
Drizzt corrected. His lavender eyes bore into Wulfgar, catching the barbarian completely by surprise with their sudden flash of anger. Wulfgar saw the incredible character in those violet pools, an inner strength within the drow whose pure quality would make the most noble of kings envious. You have grown into a man in the shadow of a dwarf of indisputable character, Drizzt scolded. Have you gained nothing for the experience? Wulfgar was dumbfounded and couldn't find the words to reply. Drizzt decided that the time had come for him to lay bare the barbarian's principles and judge the wisdom and worth of teaching the young man.
A king is a man strong of character and conviction, who leads by example and truly cares for the sufferings of his people, he lectured. Not a brute who simply rules because he is the strongest. And I should think you would have learned to understand the distinction.
Drizzt noted the embarrassment on Wulfgar's face and knew that the years in the dwarven caves had shaken the very ground that the barbarian had grown on. He hoped that Brunner's belief in Wulfgar's sense of conscience and principle proved true, for he too, like Brunner years before, had come to recognize the promise of the intelligent young man and found that he cared about Wulfgar's future. He turned suddenly and started away, leaving the barbarian to find the answers to his own questions.
The lesson?
Wulfgar called after him, still confused and surprised.
You have had your lesson for this night,
Drizzt replied without turning or slowing.
Perhaps it was the most important that I will ever teach.
The drow faded into the blackness of the night, though the distinct image of lavender eyes remained clearly imprinted in Wulfgar's thoughts. The barbarian turned back to the distant campfire. and wondered. 15. On the Wings of Doom. They came in under the cover of a violent squall line that swept down upon 10 towns from the open east. Ironically, they followed the same trail along the side of Kelvin's cairn that Drizzt and Wulfgar had traveled just 2 10-days earlier. This band of Verbeek, though, headed south toward the settlements rather than north to the open tundra. Though tall and thin, the smallest of the giants, they were still a formidable force. A frost giant led the advanced scouts of Akar Kessel's vast army. Unheard beneath the howling blasts of wind, they moved with all speed to a secret lair that had been discovered by orc scouts in a rocky spur on the southern side of the mountain. There was barely a score of the monsters, but each carried a huge bundle of weapons and supplies. The leader pressed on toward its destination. Its name was Bigrin, a cunning and immensely strong giant whose upper lip had been torn away by the ripping maw of a huge wolf, leaving the grotesque caricature of a smile forever stamped upon its face. This disfigurement only added to the giant's stature, instilling the respect of fear in its normally unruly troops. Akar Kessel had hand-picked Bigrin as the leader of his forward scouts, though the wizard had been counseled to send a less conspicuous party, some of Hishtag's people, for the delicate mission. But Kessel held Bigrin in high regard and was impressed with the enormous amount of supplies the small band of Verbeek could carry. The troops settled into their new quarters before midnight and immediately went about fashioning sleeping areas, storage rooms, and a small kitchen. Then they waited, silently poised to strike the first lethal blows in Akar Kessel's glorious assault on 10 towns. An orc runner came every couple of days to check on the band and deliver the latest instructions from the wizard, informing Bigrin of the progress of the next supply troop that was scheduled to arrive. Everything was proceeding according to Kessel's plan, but Bigrin noted with concern that many of his warriors grew more eager and anxious every time a new runner appeared, hoping that the time to march to war was finally upon them. Always the instructions were the same, though: stay hidden and wait. In less than 2 10-days, in the tense atmosphere of the stuffy cave, the camaraderie between the giants had disintegrated. Verbeek were creatures of action, not contemplation, and boredom led them inescapably to frustration. Arguments became the norm, often leading to vicious fights. Bigrin was never far away, and the imposing frost giant usually managed to break up the scuffles before any of the troops were seriously wounded. The giant knew beyond doubt that it could not keep control of the battle-hungry band for much longer. The fifth runner slipped into the cave on a particularly hot and uncomfortable night. As soon as the unfortunate orc entered the common room, it was surrounded by a score of grumbling Verbeek.
"What's the news, then?" one of them demanded impatiently.
Thinking that the backing of Akar Kessel was sufficient protection, the orc eyed the giant in open defiance.
"Fetch your master, soldier," it ordered.
Suddenly, a huge hand grabbed the orc by the scruff of the neck and shook the creature roughly.
"Yous was asked a question, scum," said a second giant. "What's the news?"
The orc, now visibly unnerved, shot back an angry threat at its giant assailant.
"The wizard will peel the skin from your hide while you watch." "I heard enough," growled the first giant, reaching down to clamp a huge hand around the orc's neck. It lifted the creature clear off the ground, using only one of its massive arms. The orc slapped and twisted pitifully, not bothering the Verbeek in the least.
"Oh, squeeze its filthy neck," came one call.
"Put its eyes out and drop it in a dark hole," said another.
Bigrin entered the room, quickly pushing through the ranks to discover the source of the commotion. The giant wasn't surprised to find the Verbeek tormenting an orc. In truth, the giant leader was amused by the spectacle, but it understood the danger of angering the volatile Akar Kessel. It had seen more than one unruly goblin put to a slow death for disobeying, or simply to appease the wizard's distorted taste for pleasure.
"Put the miserable thing down," Bigrin ordered calmly.
Several groans and angry grumbles sprang up around the frost giant.
"Bash its head in," cried one. "Bites its nose," yelled another.
By now the orc's face had grown puffy from lack of air, and it hardly struggled at all. The Verbeek holding it returned Bigrin's threatening stare for a few moments longer, then tossed its helpless victim at the frost giant's booted feet.
"Keep it, then," the Verbeek snarled at Bigrin. "But if it wags its tongue at me again, I'll eat it for sure."
"I've had too much of this hole," complained a giant from the back of the ranks, "and a whole dale of filthy dwarves for the taking."
The grumbling renewed with heightened intensity. Bigrin looked around and studied the seething rage that had crept into all of the troops, threatening to bring down the whole lair in one sudden fit of irrepressible violence.
"Tomorrow night we starts going out to see what's about us,"
Bigrin offered in response. It was a dangerous move, the frost giant knew, but the alternative was certain disaster.
"Only three at a time, and no one's to know."
The orc had regained a measure of composure and heard Bigrin's proposal. It started to protest, but the giant leader silenced it immediately.
"Shut your mouth, orc dog,"
Bigrin commanded, looking to the Verbeek that had threatened the runner and smiling wryly.
"Or I'll let me friend eat."
The giants howled their glee and exchanged shoulder claps with their companions, comrades again. Bigrin had given them back the promise of action, though the giant leader's doubts about its decision were far from dispelled by the lusty enthusiasm of the soldiers. Shouts of the various dwarven recipes the Verbeeks had concocted, Dwarf of the Apple and Bearded, Basted, and Baked, to name two, rang out to overwhelming hoots of approval. Bigrin dreaded what might happen if any of the Verbeek came upon some of the short folk. Bigrin let the Verbeek out of the lair in groups of three, and only during the nighttime hours. The giant leader thought it unlikely that any dwarves would travel this far north up the valley, but knew that it was taking a huge gamble. A sigh of relief escaped from the giant's mouth whenever a patrol returned without incident. Simply being allowed out of the cramped cave improved the Verbeek's morale tenfold. The tension inside the lair virtually disappeared as the troops regained their enthusiasm for the coming war. Up on the side of Kelvin's cairn, they often saw the lights of Caer Conig and Caer Dinnoval, Tourmaline across the way to the west, and even Bryn Shander far to the south. Viewing the cities allowed them to fantasize about their upcoming victories, and the thoughts were enough to sustain them in their long wait. Another 10 days slipped by. Everything seemed to be going along well. Witnessing the improvement the small measure of freedom had brought to his troops, Bigrin gradually began to relax about the risky decision. But then, two dwarves, having been informed by Brunner that there was some fine stone under the shadow of Kelvin's cairn, made the trip to the north end of the valley to investigate its mining potential. They arrived on the southern slopes of the Rocky Mountain late one afternoon, and by dusk had made camp on a flat rock beside a swift stream. This was their valley, and it had known no trouble in several years. They took few precautions. So it happened that the first patrol of Verbeek to leave the lair that night soon spotted the flames of a campfire and heard the distinctive dialect of the hated dwarves. On the other side of the mountain, Drizdo Erden opened his eyes from his daytime slumber. Emerging from the cave into the growing gloom, he found Wulfgar in the customary spot, poised meditatively on a high stone, staring out over the plain. "You long for your home?" the drow asked rhetorically. Wulfgar shrugged his huge shoulders and answered absently,
"Perhaps."
The barbarian had come to ask many disturbing questions of himself about his people and their way of life since he had learned respect for Drizzt. The drow was an enigma to him, a confusing combination of fighting brilliance and absolute control. Drizzt seemed able to weigh every move he ever made in the scales of high adventure and indisputable morals. Wulfgar turned a questioning gaze on the drow.
"Why are you here?"
he asked suddenly. Now it was Drizzt who stared reflectively into the openness before them. The first stars of the evening had appeared, their reflections sparkling distinctively in the dark pools of the elf's eyes. But Drizzt was not seeing them. His mind was viewing long past images of the lightless cities of the Drow in their immense cavern complexes far beneath the ground.
I remember,
Drizzt recalled vividly, as terrible memories are often vivid.
The first time I ever viewed the surface world. I was a much younger elf then, a member of a large raiding party. We slipped out from a secret cave and descended upon a small elven village.
The drow flinched at the images as they flashed again in his mind.
My companions slaughtered every member of the wood elf clan. Every female, every child.
Wulfgar listened with growing horror. The raid that Drizzt was describing might well have been one perpetrated by the ferocious tribe of the Elk.
My people kill, Drizzt went on grimly. They kill without mercy.
He locked his stare onto Wulfgar to make sure that the barbarian heard him well.
They kill without passion.
He paused for a moment to let the barbarian absorb the full weight of his words. The simple yet definitive description of the cold killers had confused Wulfgar. He had been raised and nurtured among passionate warriors, fighters whose entire purpose in life was the pursuit of battle glory, fighting in praise of Tempus. The young barbarian simply could not understand such emotionless cruelty. A subtle difference, though, Wulfgar had to admit. Drow or barbarian, the results of the raids were much the same.
The demon goddess they serve leaves no room for the other races, Drizzt explained,
particularly the other races of elves.
But you will never come to be accepted in this world, said Wulfgar. Surely you must know that the humans will ever shun you.
Drizzt nodded.
Most, he agreed. I have few that I can call friends, yet I am content. You see, barbarian, I have my own respect, without guilt, without shame.
He rose from his crouch and started away into the darkness.
Come, he instructed.
Let us fight well this night, for I am satisfied with the improvement of your skills, and this part of your lessons nears its end.
Wulfgar sat a moment longer in contemplation. The drow lived a hard and materially empty existence, yet he was richer than any man Wulfgar had ever known. Drizzt had clung to his principles against overwhelming circumstances, leaving the familiar world of his own people by choice to remain in a world where he would never be accepted or appreciated. He looked at the departing elf, now a mere shadow in the gloom.
Perhaps we two are not so different,
he mumbled under his breath.
Spies! Whispered one of the Verbeeg. Stupid for spying with a fire, said another. Let's go squash 'em, said the first, starting toward the orange light. The boss said no, the third reminded the others. We's to watch, but no squashing.
They started down the rocky path toward the small camp of the dwarves, with as much stealth as they could muster, which made them about as quiet as a rolling boulder. The two dwarves were well aware that someone or something was approaching. They drew their weapons as a precaution, but figured that Wulfgar and Drizzt, or perhaps some fishermen from Caer Conic, had seen their light and were coming to share dinner with them. When the camp came into sight just below, the Verbeeg could see the dwarves standing firm, weapons in hand.
They seen us, said one giant, ducking into the darkness. Oh, shut up, ordered the second.
The third giant, knowing as well as the second that the dwarves could not as yet know who they were, grasped the second's shoulder and winked evilly.
If they seen us, it reasoned, we's got no choice but to squash 'em.
The second giant chuckled softly, poised its heavy club on its shoulder, and started for the camp. The dwarves were completely stunned when the Verbeeg came bounding around some boulders just a few yards from their camp and closed in on them. But a cornered dwarf is pound for pound as tough as anything in the world, and these were of the clan from Mithril Hall, who had been waging battles on the merciless tundra for all of their lives. This fight would not be as easy as the Verbeeg had expected. The first dwarf ducked a lumbering swing from the lead verbeeg and countered by slamming his hammer onto the monster's toes. The giant instinctively lifted its injured foot and hopped on one leg, and the seasoned dwarf fighter promptly cut it down by bashing him in the knee. The other dwarf had reacted quickly, launching his hammer with pinpoint accuracy. It caught another giant in the eye and spun the creature crashing into some rocks. But the third verbeeg, the smartest of the three, had picked up a stone before it had charged and returned the dwarf's throw with tremendous force. The stone deflected off the unfortunate dwarf's temple, snapping his neck violently to the side. His head lolled about uncontrollably on his shoulders as he fell dead to the ground. The first dwarf would have soon finished off the giant he had felled, but the last of the monsters was upon him at once. The two combatants parried and countered, with the dwarf actually gaining a bit of an advantage. An advantage that lasted only until the giant, who had been struck in the eye by the thrown hammer, recovered enough to jump in. The two verbeeg rained blow after heavy blow at the dwarf. He managed to dodge and deflect them for a short while, but then one landed squarely on his shoulder and dropped him to his back. He found his breath in a short time, for he was as tough as the stone he had landed on, but a heavy boot stomped on him and held him prone. "Squish him," begged the injured giant the dwarf had cut down. "Then we takes him to the cook." "We does not," growled the giant above the dwarf. It ground its huge boot into the earth, slowly pressing the life from the unfortunate victim.
"Bigrin'll take us to the cook if he finds out."
The other two grew genuinely afraid when they were reminded of the wrath of their brutal leader. They looked helplessly to their more cunning companion for a solution.
"We puts them and their filthy things in a dark hole and says nothing more of this."
Many miles to the east, in his solitary tower, Akar Kessel waited patiently. In the autumn, the last and largest of the trading caravans would roll back into ten towns from Luskan, laden with riches and supplies for the long winter. His vast armies would be assembled and on the move by then, marching gloriously to destroy the pitiful fishermen. The mere thought of the fruits of his easy victory sent shivers of delight through the wizard. He had no way of knowing that the first blows of the war had already been struck. 16. Shallow Graves. When Wulfbar awakened just before midday, rested from his long night's work, he was surprised to see Drizzt already up and about, busily preparing a pack for a long hike.
"Today we start a different type of lesson," Drizzt explained to the barbarian. "We'll set out right after you've had something to eat."
"To where?"
"First the dwarven mines," replied Drizzt. "Brunner will want to see you so he might measure your progress for himself." He smiled at the big man. "He shan't be disappointed."
Wulfgar smiled, confident that his newfound prowess with the hammer would impress even the grumpy dwarf.
"And then?"
"To Tourmaline, on the banks of Mare Dualden. I have a friend there, one of my few," he added quickly with a wink, drawing a smile from Wulfgar.
"A man named Agorwal.
I want you to meet some of the people of Ten Towns so that you might better judge them."
"What have I to judge?" Wulfgar asked angrily.
The drow's dark and knowing eyes bore into him. Wulfgar clearly understood what Drizzt had in mind. The dark elf was trying to personalize the people the barbarians had declared enemies, to show Wulfgar the everyday existence of the men, women, and children who might have been victims of his own heavy pole if the fight on the slopes had turned out differently. Fearless in any battle, Wulfgar was truly frightened of facing those people. Already the young barbarian had begun to question the virtues of his warlike people. The innocent faces he would encounter in the town his people had casually marked for burning could well complete the destruction of the foundations of his entire world. The two companions set out a short time later, retracing their steps around the eastern trails of Kelvin's Cairn. A dusty wind was blowing in steadily from the east, assaulting them with fine grains of stinging sand as they crossed the exposed face of the mountain. Though the glaring sun was especially draining on Drizzt, he kept a strong pace and did not stop for rest. In the late afternoon, When they finally rounded a southern spur, they were exhausted but in good spirits.
"In the shelter of the mines, I had forgotten how cruel the tundra wind could be,"
laughed Wulfgar.
"We'll have some protection below the rim of the valley," said Drizzt.
He patted the empty water skin at his side.
"Come, I know where we might refill these before we continue."
He led Wulfgar westward, below the southern slopes of the mountain. The drow knew of an icy stream a short distance away, its waters fed from the snowmelt atop Kelvin's cairn. The brook sang merrily as it danced across the stones. Nearby birds cackled and cawed at the approach of the companions, and a lynx slipped silently away. Everything appeared as it should, but from the moment they arrived on the large flat rock that was commonly used by travelers as a campsite, Drizzt sensed that something was terribly wrong. Moving in tentatively, he searched for some tangible sign that would confirm his growing suspicions. Wulfgar, though, dived belly down onto the stone and dunked his sweat and dust-streaked face eagerly into the cold water. When he pulled it back out, the luster had returned to his eyes, as if the icy water had given him back his vitality. But then the barbarian noticed crimson stains on the rock and followed their gory trail to the hairy piece of skin that had gotten caught on the sharp tip of a stone just above the rushing stream. Both skilled trackers, the ranger and barbarian, had little difficulty in ascertaining that a battle had recently been fought on this spot. They recognized the coarse hair on the patch of skin as a piece of beard, which of course led them to think of the dwarves. They found three sets of giant-sized footprints nearby. Following a tangent line of tracks that stretched southward a short distance to a sandy patch of ground, they soon found the shallow graves.
"Not Brunner," Drizzt said grimly, examining the two corpses. "Younger dwarves. Bundo, son of Fellhammer, and Dorgas, son of Argo Grimblade, I believe." "We should make all haste to the mines," Wulfgar suggested.
"Soon," replied the drow. "We still have much to learn about what happened here, and tonight may be our only chance. Were these giants simply passing rogues, or are they lairing in the area? And are there more of the foul beasts?"
"Brunner should be told,"
Wulfgar argued. "And so he will," said Drizzt.
"But if these three are still nearby, as I believe they are since they took the time to bury their kill, they might well return for some more sport when the night falls."
He directed Wulfgar's gaze to the west, where the sky had already begun to take on the pink shades of twilight.
"Are you ready for a fight, barbarian?" With a determined grunt, Wulfgar brought Aegis Fang down from his shoulder and slapped the adamantite handle across his free hand. "We shall see who finds sport this night."
They moved behind the secrecy of a rocky bluff south of the flat stone and waited as the sun passed below the horizon and the dark shadows deepened into evening. It wasn't very long a wait, for the same Verbeek that had killed the dwarves the night before were again the first out of the lair, anxious to seek fresh victims. Soon the patrol came crashing over the mountain slopes and onto the flat rock beside the stream. Wulfgar immediately moved to charge, but Drizzt stayed him before he gave their position away. The drow had every intention of killing these giants, but he wanted to see if he could learn anything about why they were here first.
"Drats and dingers," grumbled one of the giants. "Not a dwarf to be found."
"Rotten luck it is," groaned another. "And our last night out, too."
The creature's companions looked at it curiously.
"The other group's coming in tomorrow,"
the Verbeek explained. "Our numbers'll double, and stinking ogres and orcs to boot, and the boss ain't to let us out till everything's calmed again."
"A score more in that stinking hole," complained one of the others. "Rightly to send us flipping."
"Let's be moving then," said the third. "No hunting here and no night for wasting."
The two adventurers behind the bluff tensed reflexively when the giant spoke of leaving.
"If we can get to that rock,"
Wulfgar reasoned, unknowingly pointing to the same boulder that the giants had used for their ambush the night before,
"we'll have them before they even realize we're here.
He turned anxiously to Drizzt, but backed off immediately when he saw the drow. The lavender eyes burned with a luster that Wulfgar had never witnessed before.
"There are only three of them," said Drizzt, his voice holding a fragile edge of calm that threatened to explode at any moment. "We need no surprise."
Wulfgar didn't quite know how to take this unexpected change in the dark elf.
"You taught me to seek every advantage," he said cautiously. "In battle, yes," answered Drizzt. "This is vengeance. Let the giants see us. Let them feel the terror of impending doom."
The scimitars suddenly appeared in his slender hands as he walked out around the bluff, his steady stride unnervingly holding the unswerving promise of death. One of the giants yelled out in surprise, and they all froze in their tracks when they saw the drow step out before them. Apprehensive and confused, they formed a defensive line across the flat rock. The Verbeeg had heard legends of the drow, even some where the dark elves had joined forces with giants, but the sudden appearance of Drizzt caught them totally by surprise. Drizzt enjoyed their nervous twitchings, and he held back to savor the moment.
"What are ye fur, then?"
one of the giants asked cautiously.
"A friend of dwarves," Drizzt replied with a wicked laugh.
Wulfgar leaped out beside him as the largest of the giants charged without hesitation, but Drizzt stopped him cold. The drow pointed one of his scimitars at the advancing giant and stated with deathly calm, "You are dead." At once the Verbeeg was limbed by purplish flames. It yelled in terror and retreated a step, but Drizzt stalked it methodically. An overwhelming impulse came over Wulfgar to throw the warhammer, as though Aegis Fang was exerting a will of its own. The weapon whistled through the night air and exploded into the giant standing in the middle, hurling its broken body into the swollen stream. Wulfgar was truly awestricken with the power and deadliness of the throw, but he worried about how effectively he could fight off the third giant with a small dagger, the only weapon he had left. The giant recognized the advantage as well and charged wildly. Wulfgar went for the dagger, but instead he found Aegis Fang magically returned to his grasp. He had no idea of this special power Brunner had imbued upon the weapon, and he had no time now to pause and ponder. Terrified, but having nowhere to run, the largest giant attacked Drizzt with abandon, giving the elf even more of an advantage. The monster lifted its heavy club high, the movement exaggerated by rage, and Drizzt quickly poked his pointed blades through the leather tunic and into the exposed belly. With only a slight hesitation, the giant continued its mighty swing, but the agile drow still had ample time to dodge the blow. And as the swing threw the lumbering giant off balance, Drizzt jabbed two more tiny holes into its shoulder and neck.
"Are you watching, boy?" the drow called gaily to Wulfgar. "It fights like one of your kind."
Wulfgar was heavily engaged with the remaining giant, easily maneuvering Aegis Fang to deflect the monster's powerful blows, but he was able to catch glimpses of the battle to his side. The scene painted a grim reminder of the value of what Drizzt had taught him, for the drow was toying with the Verbeeg, using its uncontrolled rage against it. Again and again the monster reared for a killing blow, and each time Drizzt was quick to strike and dance away. Verbeeg blood flowed freely from a dozen wounds, and Wulfgar knew that Drizzt could finish the job at any time, but he was amazed that the dark elf was enjoying the tormenting game he played. Wulfgar hadn't yet struck a solid blow on his opponent, biding his time as Drizzt had taught him, until the enraged Verbeeg wore itself out. Already the barbarian could see that the giant's blows were coming with less frequency and vigor. Finally, lathered in sweat and breathing heavily, the Verbeeg slipped up and dropped its guard. Aegis Fang pounded home once and then again, and the giant toppled in a lump. The Verbeeg fighting Drizzt was down on one knee now, the drow having deftly sliced out one of its hamstrings. When Drizzt saw the second giant fall before Wulfgar, he decided to end the game. The giant took one more futile swing, and Drizzt waded in behind the flow of the weapon, jabbing with one scimitar and this time following the cruel point with his full weight. The blade slipped through the giant's neck and upward into its brain. Later, one question pressed upon Drizzt as he and Wulfgar, resting on one knee, considered the results of their handiwork.
"The hammer?" he asked simply. Wulfgar looked down at Aegis Fang and shrugged.
I do not know, he answered honestly. It returned to my hand by its own magic.
Drizzt smiled to himself. He knew. How wondrous the crafting of Brunner, he thought, and how deeply the dwarf must care for the boy to have given him such a gift.
A score of Verbeeg coming, groaned Wulfgar.
And another 20 already here, added Drizzt. Go straight away to Brunner.